In this week's episode, we discuss Joey's trial and two pieces of surprise evidence that the prosecution introduced at that trial. The testimony of the mother of one of Isaac's close friends, Yvonne Agin, and the grave dog. In this addendum, you'll get to hear a review of some of the legal implications of this evidence because it was covered in a class at the Emory University School of Law. Julie Seaman, a member of the Georgia Innocence Project's board, is an evidence professor at Emory and has been using Season 2 of Undisclosed throughout this past semester to teach her students about how the evidence rules can work in the real world. The panel at the class consisted of Susan, as well as Joey's attorneys, Claire Gilbert and Ben Goldberg. John Cryer was there too via Skype, so you'll hear him, but we apologize for the poor quality. Also, as a warning, there will be a thorough discussion of the dogs in this case.
The way that this really came about was I'm the current board chair of the Georgia Innocence Project. And so when I learned that we were going to be partnering with the Undisclosed podcast on this case, I thought, wow, that could be kind of a fun thing. I hesitate to use the word fun, both in connection with law school and also in connection with, you know, what's a very serious case, because obviously someone's life is at stake and someone's freedom's at stake. Nonetheless, we try to make law school fun sometimes. And so I thought it would be fun, since we do in evidence, in the evidence course, we take a problem approach and we read the rules and we read the cases, but then we look at problems and we say, how would the rules apply to this hypothetical problem? And sometimes we look to real cases in the real world because that's kind of interesting and more fun for the students. So I thought, well, let's use this case and see how that works. So it was a bit of an experiment, partly because I didn't know and still don't know exactly when any item of evidence is going to be covered by the podcast, if at all. And so we couldn't always do it, but we tried to do it. And sometimes it worked out really well. Like, for example, the week that the podcast talked about Isaac's dog, Sally, who had been shot between the eyes while chained in her pen, that happened to be the week that we were covering the evidence rules that have to do with character evidence and also with unfair prejudice and balancing prejudice against probative value. So it was a perfect example to use in class, and we did use it in class. And so we're going to just now do a kind of a demonstration, picking out a few items of evidence and working through it as we would in our evidence class, as we have been doing throughout the semester. So with that introduction, I guess we'll start. So as I just said, in episode 6, we learned about Isaac's dog having been shot. And the timing was a little unclear, but it seems that the dog was shot in October, in the October before Isaac's murder. And at the trial, the judge allowed the prosecution to present testimony, evidence about this incident and a kind of suggestions, rumors, and other kind of testimony that Joey maybe was responsible for shooting the dog. And so what would be the issues that, the evidence issues that would arise if we were, suppose you guys are the defense attorneys and the prosecution wants to offer evidence that Isaac's dog has been shot in this way, why would that be relevant at all at the trial? Allie.
Hi.
So yeah, speak into the mic so 2 million people can hear you.
Okay. Well, it could be relevant in order to prove some sort of motive that the fact that Joey wanted to kill Isaac's dog is a sign that he had a problem with him, and it's a establishing prior history between the two
okay,
of them.
Okay, perfect. So under the rules of evidence, prior acts are not permissible, are not admissible, and we're talking about the federal rules of evidence, different from the Georgia rules in some respects, which we're going to talk about. But under the federal rules, Rule 404B says you can't use evidence of prior bad acts, essentially, to show propensity, that the person's a bad person or that because they did this act before, it's more likely that they did it on this particular occasion, propensity. But you can use it to show other things like preparation, plan, knowledge, intent, identity. And so here, the other purpose of the evidence would be, as you say it again,
motive,
right. So it tends to show a motive. So that's the non-propensity purpose. Maybe we should turn to the panel for a moment, if anyone wants to comment on how, if at all, the Georgia rules regarding prior bad acts like this are different. In particular, this bent of mind admissibility that Georgia has or had at the time of the trial.
Yeah, so I guess even though Georgia had a separate statute at the time, now Georgia has adopted basically the federal rules, but at the time of this trial, Georgia still had a statute saying you can't introduce character evidence for propensity purposes. At the same time, we had this funky rule called bent of mind, which if any of you try to distinguish that for propensity, you won't be able to. So basically, we said on the one hand, propensity evidence is not admissible, but on the other hand, we have this bent of mind exception, and that allowed judges across the state, prosecutors across the state, to go ahead and introduce this propensity evidence. Now, we've done away with the bent of mind, except for we still have some exceptions that differ from the federal rules. For example, in DUI cases, basically, a prior DUI will come in against somebody that's currently charged with it almost automatically. We also have the exception of the sex crimes that you guys have probably learned about that the federal rules have. But the bent of mind, that was a terrible aspect of Georgia law. It's good that we did away with it. And I don't know that the judge in this case really let it in under that particular exception. But back then, almost anything could still come in under that exception, I think.
Yeah, it seems like the judge didn't talk about motive or any, didn't talk about 404B at all, or the whatever the equivalent of 404B would have been, but just, yeah, that all of this stuff just came in.
I was curious, what caused the state to change the rules and adopt the federal standard? I mean, obviously, it wasn't the case of Joey Watkins, because it doesn't seem like they seem all that troubled by his conviction. What caused them to change?
So, do you want to talk about
it? Well, I mean, I can say what I know is that the defense bar in Georgia for a long time was pushing for it because of some of the funky aspects that Georgia law had, like bent of mind, and how that obviously usually hurts defendants and favors the prosecution. So the defense bar pushed for it for a long time, and eventually they made concessions that the prosecutors agreed to and vice versa, and eventually it was just pushed through after really decades of lawyers and legislators in Georgia trying to conform with the federal rules.
And I think Georgia was one of the last, if not the last, states to actually get rid of this.
I think Georgia was like the 44th or 45th state to adopt the federal rules of evidence, either, you know, in whole or in substantial part. So virtually all of them have. I mean, New York has its own code of evidence. California has its own code. But those were codes that were written that were sort of progressive at the time that they were enacted, whereas Georgia had this kind of common law, like, mixture of all these old kind of weird rules. And so it was quite a long time coming to get the federal rules adopted. And that happened in, like, 2011 or 2012. So it's been a few years. If anyone has questions, yeah. Angel?
So we kind of learned in the federal rules that there is a bit of judicial discretion in allowing evidence, even if it is admissible. So there's Rule 403 that allows them to decide whether, like, evidence is unfairly prejudicial. And so was there, like, a correlate of that at the time of Joey's trial?
Yes, they still had that balancing test at the time.
Yeah, so speaking of 403, I'm glad you raised 403. So that's another big issue that I mentioned a few minutes ago, but that we talked about, obviously, when we talked about the dog. And so, you know, when we balance probative value against prejudice under 403, do any of the students want to just talk for a minute about how, when we talked about this in class, what did you think about the prejudice versus the probative value and kind of the factors that we talked about that courts use to figure out prejudice against probative value? The balance is, it favors admissibility, as we talked about. The unfair prejudice has to be much more than the probative value in order to keep it out. So the rules want to let this kind of stuff in. But certainly, based on what we heard in the podcast, I would love it if the panelists would elaborate. But this was so extremely prejudicial. You know, what Susan said is probably the thing that turned the whole trial against Joey. So, Angel.
So in listening to the podcast, and a woman was interviewed about what she thought about a dog being shot, and she immediately said that that meant that the person who had done it had to be the worst person in the world. And so that kind of goes for me to the character of being unfairly prejudicial if you're allowing evidence like this to be brought in front of a jury. And then if it's, you know, being said that this was a past act that goes to motive, there's already kind of a line of logic that, like, leads to this that isn't automatically, it doesn't automatically follow that Joey killed Isaac just because his dog was also killed. So
that's right. But remember, I mean, it doesn't have to automatically mean it, right? It just has to be relevant to show it. And you're nodding your head, right? So a brick is not a wall, as we've said many times. So it just has to be, it has to make it slightly more probable or less probable than it would have been without that evidence. It doesn't have to be strong. But when we're balancing under 403 and thinking about probative value, the strength of the evidence, you know, if it this evidence was so questionable about whether Joey had anything to do with the dog, and so under the federal rules and the way federal courts typically would should apply them, that should be a factor in weighing the probative value and saying the probative value is less because this is so tenuous. Rick, did you have a comment? Just take the mic, though.
Just to point out quickly, in the case of Sally, so Isaac's own dog, the defense didn't object. So at trial, no objection was raised to evidence of Sally coming in, which always makes it easier.
Right.
For evidence to come in.
Yeah, objecting would have been helpful. And does anyone have any idea about why the defense might not have objected?
Oh, well, I've got a few ideas. I think in general, though, the whole lack of actual foundation here didn't confuse just the jury. I think the judge got confused. I think he was mixed up as well about what sort of evidence was actually in there to support these claims. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of talk about the dogs and like sidebars and openings. Like Tammy Colson, the prosecutor, represented, I think, several occasions how she'd be bringing the evidence of the dog in. So unless you're paying close attention and like going through with a chart like we did through the transcript, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that actually the evidence of the dog, most of it didn't make it in, and what did come in was like a few tiny threads. But given the whole universe of dog evidence, only a sliver actually ever showed up at trial.
Just on that point about the universe of dog evidence, can we talk about just a couple of other things about Sally? So one is that at the trial, at Joey's trial, one of the witnesses, and I can't remember which one, testified that Mark Free said, "We've taken care of the dog." And maybe a few witnesses said that, but at least one witness said that. And so what does that make you guys think of? Any objection that you all would think of? So a witness testifies, "Mark Free told me we took care of the dog." Hearsay. They're all saying hearsay. Yeah. So, yeah, what about that? I mean, it seems, is there any exception that anyone can think of that would have let that hearsay in? Right. So what's going on with that?
So initially, it was, is it okay to say Bill Paisley?
Paisley.
Yeah. Or Paisley, excuse me, was the one who testified at trial that stated in different ways, but one way he stated it is, quote, "the dog was taken care of," and he attributed this statement to Mark Free, was not objected to by the defense. Later, he's asked to make an assumption about what dog Mark was referring to, mm-hmm. and the defense did object to that. But there was never really a ruling on that objection. It just sort of washed away, kind of, and we went back to it anyway.
And so when you say what dog, do we want to talk about what other dog it might have been?
Yeah, so Grave Dog is the other dog in this case. I don't know who came up with the name. I think kind of both simultaneously started calling it Grave Dog. And we don't know Grave Dog's origin story necessarily, but what happened is that at the start of Joey's trial, Tammy Colson says, "Oh, look, I have something new. This weekend I found out from the victim's father that there was a dog that was shot and killed and placed on Isaac's grave. I didn't know about it before, so I didn't have time to, like, I couldn't tell the defense about it because I didn't know. But I still want to get all this evidence in about it." And it comes in. They do object to that. But the judge also relies on the fact that they didn't even object to Sally as sort of a way to bootstrap in the Grave Dog stuff. So what the jury took away was that Joey and or Mark had found some, presumably a stray, shot it between the eyes like they'd shot Sally. This is in February, so after Isaac is buried, and they'd found Isaac's grave and dumped this Grave Dog's body on top of Isaac's grave to rot. And then a few days later, some days later, after the body was rotting, Isaac's father came to the gravesite and saw the dog. At this point, the dog had been moved into the ditch next to the road. but he could tell from all the flies on the grave that originally the carcass had been placed on the grave itself. So he bagged up the carcass and tossed it into a little creek that was down behind the grave area, sort of like a ditch creek, kind of like in a pasture. And he forgot about it. He told one person about it, that was a now deceased member of the Floyd County Police Department. And he said, never tell anyone about this. So he didn't.
Well, did he not?
He told, Sutton was the only person apparently told, but Freeman said, make sure you don't tell anyone else about this. No one else can know.
So he supposedly told Sutton, though.
And Freeman said, and Sutton only can know.
Right. Which was the father's, he testified at trial that was the father's impetus for going to the Floyd County Police to get Stanley Sutton involved on the case, was the fact that there was this grave dog who had been shot in the head, just like Sally was shot in the head. So even though that's the reason why he would have went and got Sutton, and Sutton was brought on the case within a week of this time frame, the defense doesn't learn about grave dog until the Saturday before trial, a year and a half later.
Yeah. And it's not until November, so 10 months after Isaac's death, that grave dog's even brought up again. Because that's the time when Josh Lemister is in Virginia giving his confession. While on the road trip up from Georgia to Virginia, Sutton stops at like a payphone or a cell phone, we don't know, makes a call to Isaac's father and says, go find that dog carcass, I think we might want it.
So that evidence about grave dog came in at trial. And was there any objection?
Yes. Grave dog was objected to. As Susan was pointing out, part of the judge's decision in overruling the objection was the fact that they failed to object at all to Sally. But it was objected to on two different grounds, relevancy, and also that any probative value was far outweighed by prejudicial effect.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, if there had been any evidence whatsoever that Joey had anything to do with Grave Dog and or Sally, then it seems like it would have been the correct, probably, ruling to let it in, right? Because it would strongly show a motive. But the fact that there was literally nothing to tie Grave Dog to Joey at all, and the questionable evidence to tie Joey to Sally, makes the balance of prejudice and probative value look very, very different, right?
The evidence associating Grave Dog with the actual grave itself is somewhat more tenuous, I think, maybe, than is on his face apparent. Nobody ever saw the dog on the grave.
Right.
So the only time the dog was seen was next to the road outside of the graveyard. But there were flies around the dog, and there were flies around the grave, and so that's how the assumption was made that at some point the two must have been associated.
And the judge even said, I think Abernathy, the defense attorney, was in the process of objecting, and the judge says, I came up in the woods one time on rotting liquid and flies coming out of a carcass. And Abernathy's like, I just lost my train of thought. And then he ruled against the defense, and it came in.
Yeah, but that kind of points up the differences between, a lot of it is winning on the evidence rulings, right, at the trial. But then a big part is also just telling the story, and in closing, you know, if not at least during the witness's testimony and cross-examination, in the closing argument, I don't know how that went, but it seems like it was really tenuous as to whether the dog even ever was on the grave or was, like, away from the grave. No one ever saw the dog on the grave. And whether the attorneys really hammered home these weaknesses in these extremely, you know, powerful items of evidence, I'm not sure what you guys think about how that was done, whether it was done.
I had a question just in terms of, wasn't there a stalking charge also against Joey, in terms of that being a reason for them to bring both Grave Dog and Sally into the evidence?
There was a stalking charge against Joey, but that was never mentioned in connection with trying to get the dog evidence in.
Huh. Well, just because, to me, that, you know, first of all, it's odd to me that shooting somebody's dog is considered a motive to then go and shoot them as well. I mean,
right. So what it is that, yeah, no, that's a good point. So what it is that it shows that he, if he shot the dog in that way, it shows that he hated Isaac so much that he would have had a motive to kill him. That would be the reasoning. That's the lawyer brain working. I mean, you're right. It does seem a little backwards.
Well, and I think the juror took that a little differently, and I think that this was probably how many of the jurors took it, was that there was no motive in this case, right? I mean, what, he's going to go kill a high school classmate who dated his ex-girlfriend for a few months, that now they're both broken, they're all broken up and dating, happily dating other people. So that's what the jury was fixating on. Like, there's no motive, there's no motive. Like, why would he do this? Well, if you make Joey out to be a sociopath, who does not, you know, function within the psychological realm that the rest of us do, then all of a sudden there's the motive. The motive is that he's crazy, yeah, and that he doesn't think the way we do, and that is demonstrated by the fact that not only does he shoot Sally in the between the eyes and Isaac in the head, but he shoots Grave Dog in the head and leaves it on the grave.
They substituted motive with evil.
Right.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions about the dogs before we move on, maybe talk about another item of evidence? Yeah.
So once the evidence of the dog being shot was let in, the determination of whether Joey was the one who actually did it, that would be the 104B question,
great,
right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, at least under the federal rules, the burden of proof is preponderance versus right, beyond a reasonable doubt. So I was just curious if you could speak to that a little, because it seems... This is seems like the thing that really swayed the jury against his character, but they have such a lower burden of proof in determining whether they think Joey actually shot the dog, right?
Well, it's even more complicated than that, and we can get into
right.
This.
So to answer your question, though, it's a great point, and you're right. And so for all of these other acts that might come in to show any of the 404B purposes, you know, motive or identity or plan or knowledge or any of them, whether that other thing happened and whether the defendant is the one who did it is all judged by a preponderance of the evidence, not by the criminal standard beyond a reasonable doubt, which is how ultimately the jury will have to decide the case. And so that's right. If the judge thinks that a reasonable jury could find more likely than not, which is the preponderance standard, that Joey killed the dog, then that would be the threshold for the judge to let it in, you know, putting aside the 403 prejudice issue. Yeah, I mean, some states do require a higher standard. I don't know what it was in Georgia. Maybe, there was no standard in Georgia to let the stuff in. But yeah, that's exactly right.
And the other thing is, there was another connection that the state tried to make, and they tried to get that in through the ballistics examiner, Jay Jarvis, who worked at the GBI. What happened was Sammy Dawkins finds Grave Dog in February, bags it up in a plastic bag, and throws it in a ditch. Then comes back in November upon the apparent suggestion from Stanley Sutton that Grave Dog's probably important to the case, retrieves Grave Dog, and Grave Dog ends up at the GBI crime lab. The crime lab then does basically a necropsy on Grave Dog to figure out cause of death, and Grave Dog has been shot in the head between the eyes. They do an X-ray. Grave Dog has a bullet, and Grave Dog has pellets throughout his body, which show up on the X-ray. So according to a couple of ballistics experts, which you'll learn about in the podcast, the theory is that this dog, at some point in the past, had been shot with a shotgun and had the pellets, buckshot or something, yeah, bird shot. And then later, the cause of death was the bullet between the eyes. So Jay Jarvis is brought to testify at trial about this to try and, well, the prosecutor is trying to link Joey to all of this. What he wants to do is get in the X-ray. But he's the ballistics expert. They can't get in the X-ray through him. They didn't call the pathologist who did the necropsy on the dog. And Jarvis sat up there while Tammy Colston explained to the judge why this x-ray was relevant, because it shows that the dog was shot between the eyes with a bullet, if they could have just shown the x-ray. And the defense is jumping up and objecting and objecting, and the judge refuses to let the actual x-ray itself be introduced or shown to the jury, but they do let the testimony come in about the x-ray. After receiving repeated assurances from Tammy Colston that the bullet was never actually extracted from the dog. So we know that Isaac was shot with a 9mm. We don't know what...
We think we know.
We don't know what Sally was shot with, because they could never find Sally, allegedly. And so if Grave Dog was shot with a 9mm... that would tend to at least suggest that, you know, it might have been the same shooter who shot Isaac, and if they can link that to Joey, then there's your case. The problem was the prosecutors stepping forward, saying over and over that there was no bullet extracted from the dog. The judge is asking, the defense is asking, and they're saying, no, all they did was x-ray. And the judge is like, you took the dog into the crime lab to see what kind of bullet it was shot with, and you didn't extract the bullet? No, we didn't. Well, sure enough, they did extract the bullet. It was a .22. It wasn't a 9mm. And in fact, Jay Jarvis, the witness who was on the stand while they were having this conversation, had brought the .22 bullet extracted from a dog in a clear plastic container with him that day to court and gave it to the prosecutor before he testified.
Then she said that it wasn't extracted?
Correct.
Wow.
I will clarify that his chain of custody reports he gave it to her. We can't confirm beyond that he actually did.
No, he told us in the interview that he gave it to the prosecutor's investigator.
Okay, so students, you can't do that. Right. Wow. So I just wanted to talk, because it raises a lot of evidence issues, about the testimony of Yvonne Agin. And I told you a little bit about it, but just to summarize. So on the Friday before the Monday that the trial was starting, about something like 18 months after the shooting, this witness, Yvonne Agin, contacted the prosecution and told them about this incident that happened supposedly in December of 1999, just a few weeks before the January shooting. And the trial judge allows her to testify, and her testimony is basically, Isaac shows up on my doorstep that night, I was all alone, he's a good friend of her son, but her son wasn't home, he was sleeping out at someone's house, and her husband wasn't home because he worked out of town, but she was on the phone with him. And so Isaac shows up, he's white as a sheet, he's trembling, he's petrified, and he says, I drove up to my house, and Joey Watkins was sitting in my driveway facing me, headlights facing me, kind of like grinning or smirking at him. And so Isaac says he took off and Joey followed him. And her testimony was that Isaac said Joey shot at him. And so he drives to Yvonne Agin's house, and I guess he lost Joey in the chase. And she takes his keys and she moves his car around to the back of the house and covers it with a tarp to prevent Joey from, they keep using the term spotlighting, so, you know, looking around and finding him. And then he slept on the sofa. They moved the Christmas tree away from the window so he could look out the window and see if Joey were to come. And he slept there, or, you know, didn't sleep, but he was on the sofa for the night. And then when asked about, you know, did you tell anyone? Did you report this to the police? She says, no, Isaac didn't want me to report it to the police. He said that no one would believe him. And so she says she sort of tried to tell Stanley Sutton at some wedding that they both went to. She told him she needed to talk to him, but she didn't talk to him. And then ultimately she found out, like, the week before the trial was starting, that the trial was starting. And she decides, like, oh, I better call Stanley Sutton and tell him about this kind of important thing that happened. So that was the way the testimony went. We can talk about later, but at Mark Free's trial later, she testifies a little bit differently. But just in terms of at Joey's trial, if you guys were analyzing that issue, you know, it raises obviously a lot of different evidentiary issues. And so, first of all, the in-court witness is Yvonne, and she's testifying that Isaac said all this stuff to her. So all this stuff that Isaac said to her is hearsay. Why is it hearsay?
Because Isaac is not present. He's not in court, and it's an out-of-court statement for the truth of the matter asserted.
Okay, right. Offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, that Joey followed him, that Joey shot at him. All the stuff that he was recounting is offered for its truth. And so it's definitely hearsay. So what would you do with that? Would it be admissible hearsay, inadmissible hearsay, Angel?
I think, unfortunately, in my opinion, that you can find an exclusion or exception to cover it.
Okay, what exception might cover it?
An excited utterance.
Excited utterance, okay. Right, so how would that go?
Since she said that he was seemed very stressed and like shaken and was looking out of the window, if he was said to be under the stress of the situation.
Okay, right. That's exactly right. So it probably would have, should have come in as an excited utterance. Was there an objection to that hearsay?
There was an objection overall to the testimony before.
But not a specifically a hearsay objection.
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
And also, okay. I mean, no confrontation clause objection.
Right.
I mean, I would say that even if something has a hearsay exception, for when you're making your objections in the future and something comes in under hearsay, don't necessarily give up on it then. Things can come in under hearsay exceptions but still be violative of the confrontation clause. And
if he was found unavailable by being dead?
So what would we do with the confrontation clause? We just covered the confrontation clause last week. The issue here under the confrontation clause, so the confrontation clause is part of the Sixth Amendment, and it under the confrontation clause, an accused, so a defendant, a criminal defendant, has the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him, which is interpreted to mean he has the right to cross-examine witnesses against him. And so the issue is who counts as witnesses against him? And sometimes hearsay declarants, the person who says the hearsay out of court, counts as the witnesses against him. So here Isaac would be the person. And the question under the confrontation clause, as we learned under the Crawford case, anyone out there remember? Becca?
That admission of testimonial hearsay against a criminal defendant violates the confrontation clause unless the declarant is produced at trial and the defendant has an opportunity to cross-examine, or the declarant is unavailable and the defendant had a prior opportunity to cross-examine him.
Okay, right. So there was no opportunity, prior or current, obviously, to cross-examine the declarant, who is Isaac. So the question is it testimonial hearsay, right? And so is it testimonial hearsay? Because and this is the thing that the court has been working out since the Crawford case was decided, you know, a little more than 10 years ago. What does it mean to say something is testimonial hearsay? Because not all hearsay is going to be covered by the confrontation clause at all. So here, what do you guys think? Does anyone want to answer as to whether you think it's testimonial hearsay under Crawford and the cases that came after Crawford? Allie.
Well, it's certainly not slam dunk testimonial hearsay. Most of the examples that were given have to do with the witness, the declarant, going to law enforcement in interviews and specifically laying down their testimony. And then we get into these fine lines when they call 911 and police come to them. So we start dealing with whether or not it's an emergency situation.
Right.
In this circumstance, it doesn't seem like Isaac meant to accuse anyone. He was finding comfort in a friend and telling someone what had just happened. I don't think that could be called formally a testimonial or formally accusatory in any way.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And the most recent case, Ohio versus Clark, definitely supports that recent case from 2015. So the court has now made it pretty clear that if the person's talking to non-law enforcement, here he was talking to his friend's mother, right? So that's not going to be testimonial hearsay. I think that that's pretty clear it's not testimonial hearsay. So probably the confrontation clause is not going to help you there. And the other thing is, back to hearsay, in Georgia they have this, we talked about the residual exception, the kind of catch-all, if you can't find a hearsay exception, the one that you can just, you know, try and use. And Georgia had one, and I think actually they did talk about it during the trial, that necessity exception. And so a lot of stuff came in at this trial under the necessity hearsay exception, which is just basically the declarant is unavailable and it seems trustworthy. So both of the parts of the residual exception that we talked about in class, you know, you need it and it seems pretty good, pretty reliable. So that's what the judge seems to have said. And then what about impeachment? Can we talk a few minutes about impeachment? So she said all this stuff at trial, but she hadn't said anything up until then. Can we impeach her with that? Is it a prior inconsistent statement, the fact that she didn't say this before and now she's saying it? No, you think no? So sometimes if a person makes a statement and they leave a lot of stuff out, and then they make a statement later and they put all the stuff in, the courts will find that that's a prior inconsistent statement. You can impeach the witness with that. So you could try to make that argument, right? Seems like if this had happened, the person would have said it before, you know, the 2 days before the trial.
I think it would be different if she had had an interview with the investigators and they had asked her questions about what she knew and she omitted it.
Uh-huh.
But simply not coming forward, silence in this case, I think silence can sometimes be an inconsistent previous statement, but not here.
You now am revealing that I just teach this stuff. I don't actually know what happens in the courtroom. So the fact that the person never makes a statement and then they do, can you not impeach them with that?
No, you can still impeach them with it.
And how would you do that?
I can't really cite a particular rule, but you basically would just say, well, you know, 18 months have gone by, Miss Agin, and you haven't said a word about this previously, have you?
Her response is that she did at a wedding the summer before, so about 5 months after Isaac's death. She went to a mutual wedding with, well, Stanley Sutton's nephew, and saw her friend Stanley there and said, hey, I have something very important to tell you, but this is not the right occasion at a wedding. Let's talk later. And then
nothing.
Another year goes by, and right before trial, her son comes home and says, hey, Joey Watkins' trial is next week. And she's like, gosh darn it, Stanley never got back to me. I should probably call someone. So.
And, you know, just the fact that, can you imagine Stanley not getting back to someone on that? Like, he was going out, you know, rustling up evidence under every rock. He was turning over every rock to find something, and then someone says, I have this really important thing to tell you about. Like, Isaac told me that Joey shot at him, and, oh, I suddenly forgot.
There's no way. I had a witness tell me this weekend that all of her friends started suspecting that Stanley Sutton had the hots for her, as they put it, because he thought she might have known some vague thing, and he was there once, twice a week, coming by, saying, oh, it's in the neighborhood, wanted to say hi and use your phone. Well, we know Agin and Stanley did talk, but if Agin had said, I have something important to tell you, Stanley would have been there constantly.
There is a note in Sutton's notes. He makes a notation that he had seen Agin around the time when we think this wedding was.
Same day.
The same day, actually. And Susan can find anything in old newspaper.
Luckily, Rome like documents everything, like any engagement, any wedding, like the whole list of attendants are there. It's great.
But it doesn't say anything other than spoke to Yvonne Agin.
And that she worked at the Georgia State Patrol.
Okay, so which brings us to the next impeachment method, bias. Okay, so she had a pending felony charge. She had worked for the Georgia State Patrol. She had been charged with... What exactly was she charged with? You guys know? Yeah, Rick?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is selling blank driver's licenses?
Okay.
Is this what it was?
So, like, basically selling fake IDs?
Something in that vein.
Okay.
I forget the actual charge's name. It was, like, fraudulent issuance of IDs. Basically, people who couldn't pass driver's tests for, like, commercial licenses, she'd
make them
pass them. Yeah.
Okay. So what do you guys think about this pending charge? Could she be impeached with this? Yes.
So under the federal rules, she probably would have been impeached under Rule 608, which is usually when a witness's character for untruthfulness comes out. Only issue is, though, is that it's a pending conviction and it's not a current conviction. And so that's kind of where the problem comes in, because there was no present conviction there.
Okay. Under the federal rules, a conviction, if you want to impeach her character for truthfulness to show that the witness is not a truthful person, and therefore more likely to be lying on the witness stand, if she has a conviction, then we would look at Rule 609. She doesn't have a conviction, you're right, so we would look at Rule 608, and under 608 we're looking for, did she do something that demonstrates a character for untruthfulness? And in that case she could be, remember, asked about it, but the evidence couldn't be actually introduced. And so would this be the sort of thing under 608B that you could ask, that the cross-examiner could ask the witness about this, the conduct that underlies the charge, selling licenses to people or getting people licenses who couldn't pass their test? Does that demonstrate her character for untruthfulness?
Basically, if you asked about it, it would not be an issue. But under 608B, you can't provide any extrinsic evidence.
Exactly right.
It's barred under the federal rules.
Okay, right. So you couldn't use extrinsic evidence, but she could have, under the federal rules, she could have been cross-examined because this is, this fraud, it's fraudulent. So it's not like a prior, you know, violent crime where it doesn't go to her character for truthfulness. This is fraud. And so certainly she could have been asked about it in the discretion of the court. And the problem was, or maybe one of the problems was, that they don't have that rule in Georgia, or didn't at the time. So there was no 608B equivalent in Georgia. And so because there was no conviction, she could not be asked about this prior untruthful behavior. Is that right?
Well, she could be asked about bias, that it would, how that would influence her testimony in terms of, I mean, this is the same DA's office presiding over her pending case that's prosecuting the trial that she's testifying in, and she could
same judge.
Okay. And so at least at the time, and I think the rules are different now, you're right, at the time you'd be able to ask her, and they did in this case, the judge allowed them to ask her about whether she had a pending charge. He did not allow her them to go into the specific nature of it.
Right.
And that's within his discretion at the time. But I'd say one thing that they omitted that you would absolutely want to do here, and I guess this probably wouldn't be, I think this would still be, you'd be able to do this under in Georgia law. You'd be able to ask her, regardless of whether you could name the offense that she was facing a charge for, you could ask her about the amount of time she's facing. Because that's really what the issue is she's testifying to curry favor with the prosecutor to what? To keep her own butt out of jail. So you'd be able to go into the specifics. Well, you are facing 1 to 10 years in prison on this case that you have pending, aren't you, Ms. Agin? And I think even though the extrinsic evidence wouldn't be admissible, and maybe the judge could exclude the name of the charge that you're facing, you would be able to still impeach them with the amount of time that they might be looking at.
Right. So there's two separate types of impeachment that we were talking about. So one is the bias, and that is she has some charge pending, and therefore she has a motivation to curry favor with the prosecution and to, you know, try to get them to cut her a deal. So that doesn't depend on the specific underlying facts, but as Ben said, just about what kind of punishment she might be facing or what kind of consequence. So that's bias. The truthful character, the untruthful character part, that's a completely separate thing. And under the federal rules, there wouldn't have to be any charge at all. But if you've done conduct that shows that you have an untruthful character, like, you know, we've talked about lied on a, you know, job application or something, that's not a crime, you're never going to be charged with it, but it shows that you're an untruthful person, a witness who has done things like that can be asked about them, any witness, because it goes to their untruthful character, and that's 608B, and that's the specific rule that there was no equivalent for in Georgia at the time, and maybe even still.
It's worth noting, too, that it's kind of odd that there wasn't a trial here or a verdict, because the whole ID issue started in 98, and she didn't go to trial until 4 years later after Mark Free's trial, and she testifies both trials how very strange her case just keeps getting pushed back and pushed back, and she has no idea why. I mean, one way to avoid having a witness impeached for a conviction for crime dishonesty is to just make sure she's not convicted yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was something like that also in Adnan's case, right? Where was there some, not specifically about impeachment, but sort of like holding back the charges for a super long time until...
That was holding back the sentencing of Jay so they could represent to the jury that he was facing jail time when they knew he wasn't.
Any other questions, comments for our panels?
Could the defense have also brought in her pre-existing relationship with Isaac and with the officers that were investigating the crime with Sutton in terms of bias impeachment? I don't know, like, if there were, like, text messages between her and Isaac or something that would show that they had a relationship and she had, like, a motive to maybe fabricate something for him.
They had to bring that in to get the evidence in the first place under necessity, because the other part of that was, like, one, unavailable, and two, what was the phrase, particularized?
Guarantees of trustworthiness.
So they had to show, like, guarantees of trustworthiness, which was in the form of their supposed close relationship. They had a friend of Isaac testify that Isaac liked to go over to their house and hang out with his friend's mom and tell her all kinds of things and have heart-to-hearts with her. So they did introduce that, but not for impeachment. That was by the state in order to get it in as necessity.
Yeah, and I don't know if it really would show, the fact that she was close with Isaac, I don't know if it shows bias toward the prosecution so much, because, you know, presumably if she wants to help Isaac, helping Isaac would be like, what, finding out who actually killed him. But so it's more, I mean, the party here is less the victim, I think, and more the state, if you're talking about bias toward or against a party.
Also, maybe one other issue is that a lot of these things get sort of dropped on the defense at the very last minute. So one thing about Gravedog is that they had no idea about Gravedog until literally the Saturday before the trial started on Monday. And this was actually one other objection that we forgot to mention earlier. They objected because for scientific evidence, and they were going to have, they had the GBI expert testify about Gravedog. You're supposed to get at least 10 days lead time. And DA said, well, I just found out about it a couple days ago, so I couldn't do it. And for some reason, whatever, that worked. So it was a super busy Saturday before trial. And there just wasn't time, I guess. There wasn't time to go back and try to find subpoena phone records or other sorts of things. It might have been smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why I think this has been interesting, and we were talking about the theme of law in the books versus law on the ground, you know, where the rubber meets the road in the courtroom, and the differences between how we would analyze it in the classroom versus how it turns out in the courtroom. And certainly one of those differences is the time pressure and the fact that, you know, all these things are being dumped on the defense, as Rick said, at the 11th hour with literally no time for them to either investigate it or even think about what to do with it. So I hope that that's been interesting for the class in terms of seeing this, how this case has turned out. I hope it hasn't been, on the other hand, like turning everyone into cynics about, you know, how the justice system actually operates, but...
this is exactly how it operates.
Like, if you're not now, you will be soon. Sorry.
Yeah, they're still idealistic. We don't want to take that away from them so soon, but... So if anyone wants to say anything about that or ask any, you know, final questions to any of the panelists or to John, Chelsea.
So my question is, what kind of recourse does the defendant have when his counsel, when they're not objecting to things that are material to his defense in the case?
Yeah, great question.
So this is pretty complicated, and you'll learn about it, but there's a claim you can raise on appeal called ineffective assistance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment, under the Georgia Constitution's provision about your right to effective assistance of counsel. And, you know, it's very, very, I do a lot of appeals. That's mostly what I do, is people appealing their criminal convictions. It's a very, very frustrating area of the law, because if you take, let's take one piece of evidence that the prosecutor tries to introduce and the trial lawyer objects to it and the judge lets it in anyway, okay? And then let's take the same example. The prosecutor wants to introduce this evidence, and like in this case, the defense lawyer doesn't object to it. Okay, the same evidence in both situations, but it is going to be so much harder for you to win your appeal when you have to raise it under ineffective assistance than when you can raise it as a direct trial error. But that's the remedy. It's a very, very high burden, very difficult to overcome to prove that you were deprived of your constitutional right to effective assistance. It gets raised every day in courts around this state. And if you were to read the opinions that come out of the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, it gets raised in almost every appeal, which is not good, because it's sort of the appellate courts are so used to it, it kind of dilutes from when there are actually good claims. But I've had it in, say, probably about 50 cases, and I've won on that issue a couple times. Very difficult.
But it didn't get raised here. The ineffective assistance of counsel did not get raised on the direct appeal in this case, because the attorneys doing the direct appeal are the same law firm that did the trial. So they can't raise ineffective assistance against themselves or their malpractice
obvious
insurance.
Obvious conflict of interest. Yeah.
So they, ineffective assistance of counsel was raised at the habeas proceeding, but by that time, time, it's kind of so far removed. It really just focused on at the habeas proceeding, it was about the cell phone evidence and the defense's inability to understand and effectively use the cell phone evidence to prove Joey's innocence.
I'm just kind of curious as to how you guys see your role in the podcast. Are you guys like advocates for Joey Watkins, or are you closer to journalists trying to present an objective account of the facts? Where do you guys see your role in all of this?
Advocate.
Well, that was Claire, right? So you're his attorney.
Yes.
And how, Susan, how about you?
It's not, the work I'm doing is similar to what I do for my own cases. I'm approaching as an attorney, so I am an attorney. But at the same time, I have no duties to Joey. I have no obligations to him. There are things that I'm sure Claire is like, God, Susan, why don't you put on the podcast?
Every week.
So there's definitely stuff I would never, if I was his like attorney in court, I would never bring it up. I would never talk about it. But because it's, for me, this is about showing how the system, well, didn't work in this case. I'm not worried about harming Joey by showing evidence that might look bad but was still a part of the story. It's kind of freeing in that respect, because I can tell the whole story. I don't have a client's like best interest to worry about. But at the same time, we've obviously looked at the case and reached a conclusion, which I've been asked before about this, the whole journalist versus lawyer thing, and I don't know enough about journalism probably to answer it appropriately, but for me, I see nothing unobjective about thoroughly looking into a case, reaching a consensus and a conclusion, and presenting it that way.
Yeah, but one of the things I think also that the podcast really reveals is how, if you think about the amount of work that has gone into what the podcast has done, the amount of resources on this case, you know, there's no way that even most of the time private attorneys, which you know, Joey had a very well-respected private firm, they don't do this. And public defenders, I mean, they're handed the file like that morning and told to dispose of the case. And so, you know, if this is what it takes to reveal what actually happened, or to reveal, you know, the problems with the investigation or the problems with the prosecution, there's just no way that, you know, the vast majority of defendants are getting anywhere close to a fair shake at that.
And that's what's been so interesting about it from our end. I mean, Rick had worked on the case for almost a year before he left, and I worked on it for many, many months before the podcast got involved, and then we've worked on it together. But just the way they can sort of drill down into all these little things that at the time I'm like, where are you going with this? But they do
often
just,
nowhere.
Yeah, sometimes nowhere. But a lot of times they're really able to kind of weave it all together and put the facts in a new light that is just, I listen and I'm like, whoa, I never thought of it that way. And that happens, I mean, almost every week. So there's still so, I mean, they're saving the best stuff for last in the podcast. I mean, and it's, they've had to push back production another month, I think, in order to. Yeah.
And cut out a lot of material, too. We just couldn't. I had so many, like, side stories I really wanted to get into, but the end of the day, I was like, actually, it's kind of just entertaining and not moving the case. So they got axed.
But there's still a lot that is moving the case, and it just makes you wonder, like, what about all these other cases?
Yeah. So even though you have finals coming up, I hope you'll keep listening, because there's a lot more coming.
For me, what I always enjoyed about the podcast was less of the advocacy aspect and just the in-depth investigation of the process. And that, to me, is of incredible, immense value just to people who aren't law students or people involved in the criminal justice system. That's the reason I became involved, just I'm fascinated by watching this process, and then I get to actually ask all these questions of the people who are actually getting into the nitty-gritty is incredibly valuable to me.
Okay, so a couple more questions.
So I think, and I love that the podcast has introduced a lot of people to the idea of wrongful convictions. It's kind of, I like that it's more introduced me into how you kind of overturn that. And so the idea of like new evidence being able to reopen a case if it is important enough struck me. And I guess I'm wondering, like, based on all the evidence that you do present in the podcast, I'm sitting here thinking, like, how on earth could this not be evidence that should reopen the case? After that, so then if you ever do get to that point where the case is reopened, looking at the federal rules of evidence really quick, 803.22, I think, says that past convictions, like the facts of those past convictions, can just kind of be imported just all into the new trial. So, like, how do you fight that uphill battle?
That's a hearsay exception. We don't need to worry about that. But just in terms of what's going to happen with going forward, do you want to talk about that at all?
Well, what I can say is that what you were just talking about, like, it sounds like there's so much, but it doesn't actually turn out to be that much that we can use in court. Mm-hmm. It's really, and we go back and forth trying to figure out exactly what that's going to be, but it's pretty limited. And we want to be smart about what we use. We want to use the most powerful, important things. So I think you'll be shocked at how few things we end up using, but it's this process that has led us to identify those things.
Well, because you can't relitigate the case that was already litigated, right? And so that does go mm-hmm. to your question about, you know, the hearsay exception about the prior conviction. You know, it has to be new evidence to be able to get anywhere. And that's why the podcast, I think, investigation has been really... It was the only chance for Joey, because there had to be new evidence uncovered or he was done, you know?
Proof of innocence is not enough.
Right.
Neither are recantations.
The investigation seems remarkably unethical, just the way they trolled the jail for witnesses and told the FBI he was leading a gang. How do you prevent that from happening? I mean, is there any outside body that governs police law enforcement? If it's all internal policy, since that creates no rights in the defendant, is it effective at all?
Transparency. Access to court records, making it public.
And I also think awareness, like people being aware of the fact that this occurs, will kind of shine a light on the police and hopefully over time prevent those practices.
But it would be difficult to find a remedy against investigators that even produce, and I'm not saying that's true in this case, but produce, you know, fake evidence, things of that nature. That you know, it's very difficult to sue the government. And I'm not a civil lawyer, so I can't really expound upon it, but you'd have a lot of obstacles to overcome there, unfortunately.
The problem is the victims of these sort of activities are the people in jail for crimes and their families, and no one believes them. No one's going to listen to them. The Watkins family has been telling people for years about things that happened to Joey until he gave up because no one wanted to hear it. And no one believed a word they said, because why? I mean, they're just sad that their brother and son went to prison, and, you know, they're just holding on to any kind of tiny thread of hope. Obviously, the police didn't do this.
But Isaac Dawkins is also a victim, because the real perpetrator is still out there.
Right. Thank you guys all so much for participating. Thank you to all the people on the panel, to Rick, to John for Skyping in with us. This has been really great, interesting, and I'll see you at the hearsay review class on Wednesday.
I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to this very special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I also want to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for providing audio production. I want to thank Patrick Cortez, who composed the new addendum theme. And finally, I want to thank Mithal Telhan, who is our producer.